Welcome to the Going to Seed podcast. I'm your host, Shane Simonson, and we're here today with independent plant breeder, Greg Flood. So tell us a bit about your background.
Thanks a lot. Really happy to be here. My background is, well, I trained in my undergrad as a botanist, and then I did a PhD in plant genetics and followed that with a postdoc, which was a really fun one where I got to go all over Africa, climbing up mountains, sampling plants and studying how they adapt to extreme environments, particularly tropical alpine ecosystems. And then how I switched to plant breeding was because I was very dedicated to that academic track. And then the pandemic happened and I was supposed to be writing a grant. And then there was no daycare and I had two young children and I had to make a choice, you know, be a father or write a grant. And obviously the only choice was to be a father. And then I had a lot of time to think. And one of the things that struck me was how poorly prepared we were for the pandemic. And I thought, well, this is a relatively simple problem compared to climate change and sort of the ecological challenges we're facing in the coming decades and centuries. And I'm looking at my kids and thinking about the world they're going to be growing up in. And I thought, I want to do something more applied. And then I decided, well, what can I do? I like food. I like genetics. Well, plant breeding is the way. So that's when I started shifting my career away from studying at a fundamental plant level how plants adapt to using that knowledge to make them adapt in ways that are useful for humans.
Brilliant. Brilliant. That's such a great story. I want to ask a million questions, but we probably should keep focused. So that was the path that led you to crop breeding. So what conditions are you working with to breed crops today? So tell me about all the different aspects, like what resources and challenges are you working with?
Sure. So I do, broadly speaking, three kinds of crop breeding, right? So one is hobby. So I have a few things that I do as a hobby. And then I do breeding for the highest input system you can possibly imagine. So the opposite end of the spectrum to what you work with. And that's indoor farming. So that's actually what pays the bills. So I get paid to do breeding for an indoor farming company. And then I also have my own. So that's like 4 days a week. And then one day a week, I have my own business, which is breeding the opposite end, which is low input crops. And that's about de novo domestication. So I'm trying to create new crops from wild species.
Brilliant.
And yeah, so then the conditions, of course, in the indoor farming setting are highly controlled. And I actually do most of the breeding in a greenhouse because it's a bit easier to get in and move around and work with the plants than in the kind of vertical farming setup. And then for the hobbies of my garden, I have a very small garden because it's the Netherlands and there's not a lot of space in this country. And that's very sandy soil. But where I do my sort of commercial breeding for the de novo domestication, or at least I try to do larger scale breeding, is I rent land in the neighborhood. And where I'm located is in the middle of the Netherlands. It's a place called Wageningen. And there's a pretty famous agricultural university located here. And the reason that it was located here is that within a small radius, basically all the soils of the Netherlands occur because they wanted to have a place where they could train farmers for, like, they could all come here and no matter where in the country they were from, they could train them on the soils that they would be working with when they went back home. So that means that my Aardakker, which I'll probably tell you about in a few minutes, breeding program right now, I have it on both heavy clay and light sand. And there's alluvial soils. There's all sorts of soils all around this area.
Brilliant. And how much space is your own garden, the small plots that you rent around?
So my own garden is pretty small. I think it's about 10 meters by 4 or 5 meters. And then there's a shed in that. And then part of it is space for the kids. So about a half of that I can use for some breeding, and there the hobby crops are things like I play around with tomatoes. I've been trying for several years unsuccessfully to get seed out of garlic, like true seed, because I'm too stubborn to use the ones that everybody succeeded with. So I try to use the ones that nobody succeeded with to get some genetics that hasn't been accessed. And then I also play with what else as a hobby. Oh yeah, I have some actually kind of like, it's funny because Joseph's book, Land Grace Gardening, which I came across because of this podcast, is an approach I've been taking independently because I come from an evolutionary genetics perspective. And then I also have the quantitative genetics and plant breeding. So I started wanting to evolve populations for my garden. And it's basically landrace gardening, but I always thought of it as evolutionary stewardship of, yeah, of these populations. And so then I play with sunflower and coriander, and I sort of try to keep these populations alive and just make sure they survive. And then the ones that I like the most, I give a helping hand to, or I don't harvest them, and then the other ones I harvest. So it's a very laissez-faire breeding approach. So that's the hobby stuff, right? That's just for fun, see what pops out, see what comes up, you know. And then the indoor farming, that's more controlled crosses. And there I work with peas and wheat, like bread wheat, mm-hmm, and also dwarf tomatoes. So they're all selfing species. So if you want crossing, you've got to do it yourself. And also there's no pollinators or anything like that. So it's a very controlled setting. And there it's quite nice because I came up with sort of a vision for how these plants need to look morphologically. So I have what we call an ideotype, so an ideal morphology. So I'm completely reshaping peas, and I'm using old mutations that Mendel worked with and that have been completely forgotten about. They're still present in like medieval varieties of peas. They're called crown peas, where they put all the pods on top. Oh. And then I combine that with elite snap peas, and then I make them short. And it's all surprisingly low tech because we don't have the budget for genomics and markers. So it's all phenotypic markers and mostly Mendelian traits. And then the traits that I'm really interested in are architectural and cycle time. So you want them to flower really quick and do many generations per unit time and grow under things like 24-hour photoperiod, grow well in hydroponics with LED lighting. So very, very, very different. And then the other stuff, which is all about the novum mesication, most of that is a focus of Lathyrus tuberosus, Aardacker. And that's this protein-rich tuber crop. So it's a nitrogen-fixing, yeah, tuber. So it's kind of like a protein-rich potato, effectively, but it's in the pea family.
Can you tell us a bit of the history of the Aardacker? Because it has, like, it's been eaten by humans on and off as far back as you can imagine. So, but it's one of these kind of lost crops of Europe, which is like the last place you think there'd be all that many lost crops, but they're there. They're there if you look.
Yeah, they certainly are. And that's not the only one I'm working with. I'm working with a few others that were big in the Mesozoic. So we can talk about that in a bit. But yeah, so the Aardacker, there's not a lot of information available. So most of the information that you can find on this species is in the ethnobotanical literature. And there, what's funny is there's rarely a paper on the Aardacker. It's just somebody has done an ethnobotanical study of a given region, and then they list all the species and they talk about it. What's interesting is that in many of these papers, you know, they describe maybe 50 species that this local community uses or used to use or something like that. There's often a note just for the Aardacker, where there's a little note where they say, this one's extra delicious. So that is always, or they say something else like, the children would look for this.
Yeah.
And of course, children only look for things that are nice.
Yep.
So this is a real vote, and it is a very tasty thing. And it's been sort of highly prized as a tasty food in across Europe. And I should say not just Europe, but Eurasia. So its natural range is from basically the Netherlands all the way to Lake Baikal. Mm-hmm. And there are populations on the Pacific coast of Russia, but it's unclear whether they're native or not. But certainly to Lake Baikal, it's native. And then like Kyrgyzstan up into almost northern Siberia. I mean, there are populations in Murmansk, mm-hmm, and all the way down to Turkey. And there are records of it in Morocco and North Africa, but it's possible that it's gone extinct there, but it definitely grows down to the Mediterranean. So it has this massive range. Naturally, it's probably a grassland species, but it has adapted to crop fields. So it also historically was a weed of wheat and barley and cereal fields, but it was one of those weeds that prior to mechanized agriculture was tolerated because it was a useful weed. You can eat the leaves, you can eat the tubers, they're nutritious, it fixes nitrogen. So it was never a weed which was, I think, you know, there are some weeds that are just problematic, right? They're toxic. Maybe the seeds get into your grain and they make your bread not so nice. Mm. But this was not one of them. And it has been apparently grown on some commercial scale in the 1700s in the Netherlands, in Zeeland, and exported to France. but it's very hard to find. That's like one small reference, and it's very hard to find like concrete evidence on that. They say they made perfume with the flowers in the Rhine Valley, and the flowers do smell amazing. They smell like roses. So yeah, it's been used in different ways. It's still gathered actually as a salad vegetable in Turkey, because it's like pea shoots. They're quite nutritious. So yeah, it's quite a useful plant.
Amazing. How did you source your original material? Like how much diversity have you managed to tap into?
Oh, I have a lot of diversity. I'm obsessive about diversity. I always like to get more and more and more. Originally, I ordered seeds from there's a company here in the Netherlands called Breken Zaden, and they do all of these weird edible crops. You can even get things like wioko and stuff from them, which are generally very hard to source. So they had seeds, and that's how I started. But it's native, and it grows around the town where I live here. So then I went out and I collected some. And then I got more from stock centers. So the USDA have a small collection. They were able to send some to some stock centers here. There's one in Germany that's willing to share and send seeds. And I, by hook or by crook, I managed to get accessions from, I think, like 10 different countries. Mm. And it's largely outbreeding. So you get basically a population from each of those places. Sometimes the wrong species. So and sometimes the wrong genus. But that's okay. And yeah, I would love to collect more. But unfortunately, this wonderful thing, the Nagoya Protocol and the CBD Convention on Biological Diversity, make it basically impossible, which is something I actually really upsets and frustrates me, because I think the Nagoya, I've had to get these permits before for when I was in academia. So I know what it's like to try and get these permits and the rigmarole that you go through. And it takes literally years to get a collection permit. And that's even for a common weed, which is what I was working on at the time. And it's absurd. And I know people who have stopped working on crops and on crop wild relatives in regions of the world because of this protocol. And it epitomizes the, you know, that phrase, the path to hell paved with good intentions.
Yeah.
Somebody had a good intention here and it's totally backfired. I think it's probably the one piece of legislation which has done more to erode genetic diversity than anything else.
Yeah.
Because people aren't studying these things. They're just being lost. And somebody like me who says, oh, I'd love to go out and do something like domesticate this wild species, right? I'm not stealing anything from anybody. I'm just trying to, like, people go out there and cut those plants down when they grow in the hedgerow, and that's fine. And I could go and just pick up some of those seeds, and suddenly I'm breaking the law.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real tragedy. And sorry, I'm getting on.
No,
I'm getting
no,
on
no.
Rant here now.
This is an important issue. Do you have any concept of how legislation like that could be amended or rolled back?
I would get rid of it. Mm. That's it. So there is this idea of access and benefit sharing, right? But which sounds good, right? And I think, like, for example, if a company goes in or a commercial enterprise goes into a region and they consult with locals, indigenous or whatever, and these people tell them about this plant that's useful for a certain medical purpose or whatever, they should be compensated for, or like that knowledge that they give should be valued. And the easiest way to do that is to pay them for it, right? But that I agree with. This idea, though, that germplasm belongs to a country where it happens to be growing, I don't agree with. I think it's a global, in my opinion, it should be a global commons, which is how it was before.
Yeah.
And that the thing is that people don't really, I'm sure the listeners understand, but plant breeding, like, it takes a bit of effort, right? And a bit of time and dedication.
A lot of chance and a lot of risk of getting nothing.
Yes, exactly. So you're going to take the shot to, for example, especially something like domestication program. You know, if it's already not something that a lot of people are willing to put their time and energy into, right? And then you put up additional barriers. That means, like, for example, these permits and stuff, that just means that there's so much potential there in the natural world, right? There's like 20,000 species of plant, depending on who you ask, that we can eat. We get most of our calories from, like, 95% from 30 species. That's an unnecessarily precarious position to be in. Everybody's calling for diversifying our food systems. Governments are saying we need to do this, we need to do this better. And then when people like me say, okay, great, I'd like to go and actually dedicate my life to doing something like this, then they say, okay, well, you got to fill out these million forms. And then when you go to different, every country does it differently. And basically they're expecting you to put a brown envelope under the table. And what it means is only those with a lot of resources have access to this now. So companies that are able to pay these kind of things, or that have the right network so that they know the people in the permitting office. So the access and benefit sharing, the only people that benefit are the local bureaucrats.
Yeah.
And everybody else is left out. And it results in a kind of capture of all this potential germplasm by those that have the resources to access it. So I would just open it up again. That would be my response to this.
Do you feel like you have enough founding genetic diversity for the project as it is?
Yeah, I've been lucky. I've been able to get a lot of genetic diversity. And because it's an outbreeding species, I'm pretty confident that there's a lot of sequence diversity already, like within the subpopulations. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to sample quite a bit in the Netherlands, where it's allowed. And also in some of the Western European countries. These countries tend to be much less protective, because I think they also, a little bit like you said, hey, who would have expected a forgotten crop to be in Europe? Everybody sort of feels that all the valuable biodiversity is probably not in Europe, which is maybe not true, but it means that they're much less protective about it. So they're much like, of all countries in the world, the only one that didn't sign up to the Nagoya is America. And it's the easiest place to get germplasm from. And they'll just ship it to you, no questions asked. It's amazing.
I'm very jealous of people who can tap into those amazing resources.
Yeah, I mean, Australia's. Yeah.
We're very cut off down here. I mean, we do have our own indigenous species that we can tap into. And a lot of the edible ones aren't especially protected or rare. But yeah, getting stuff in from outside is a challenge. So with the Lathyrus tuberosus, can you tell us a bit more about how it grows?
Yeah.
And how does it perform? And what are your priorities in breeding it too?
Yeah, so it looks quite a bit like a pea, but with smaller leaves. And it looks like a sort of graceful pea, I would say. I also breed peas, so I feel I can say that. And it grows with underground stolons. And then from these stolons, at the internodes from these stolons, roots drop down, and some of those roots form storage tubers. So it's a root tuber, which means it's more like cassava or sweet potato. It's not a stem tuber like a potato would be. And it tends to spread over a large area. So it forms these kind of patches when you see it in the wild, where they might be, could be one clonal individual that they're perennial. So they live in the same location for many, many years. And then it has these nice pink, dark, sometimes red flowers. It can be light pink to almost dark red flowers that smell really nice. And then from them, you get these kind of like little pea pods. And the funny thing about it is the pods don't shatter. They're really hard to open, which I find really unusual for wild species. So I really don't know what its dispersal mechanism is. I still haven't figured that out. It does tend to occur near rivers and in floodplains. So that could be one. And it does also spread by stolons. And as I said, it can be perennial. So maybe it doesn't really need to spread by seed that often. Mm-hmm. So having not a great dispersal mechanism is maybe not a problem. But yeah.
I wonder if a megafauna used to browse on it and the seeds went through.
It's possible. It is. I think, I mean, it's not really known as, actually, we know so little about most species, to be honest. Mm. We really know so little. And from, I've studied it in as much detail as I can. And I've looked, there's this online thing, we spoke about it a bit before, iNaturalist. And I've reviewed every single observation on iNaturalist to study it in all the different possible habitats. This and going into the field and looking for it myself, I think it's certainly it grows in anthropogenic conditions, like as a weed along field edges and things like that. But its natural habitat, I'm pretty sure, is grassland ecosystem. So then, you know, of course, megafauna did exist not that long ago in Europe. So that's entirely possible that that was a way that it moved around. I don't know. And then with regards to breeding program, the number one goal, of course, is yield. I mean, you could probably rank the most important breeding goals as being yield. Because its yield is pretty low. And I think that's why it never really got adopted as a crop. I think there are probably other reasons which are less to do with this species and more to do with, well, what are the reasons we have the crops we have in the first place? But yeah, so one is yield. The other one then would be, I tried to improve the tuber shape, because you can get because it's a root tuber, it can get forked and branched like an ugly carrot. And that's not really a problem per se, but it makes it really annoying in the kitchen when you want to peel it or something like that. So it's much nicer if you have a nice smooth round or oval tuber. And then after that, I also try to, although it's not very easy to phenotype, but I have some collaborations where we try to measure some protein content on the tubers. And I would obviously like to at least maintain the protein content or increase it, and then taste. But the latter two, taste and protein content, are, I can only measure them on a very small subset of individuals. So then I go with yield first, and then of the top yielding individuals, I measure these other traits.
Do you have any suspicion that a grower can assess protein levels by taste? Is there like a, I'm really curious about finding ways of empowering people without access to like labs and machinery to assess
it's
useful
a good question
traits?
It's a good question, and it's actually a nice idea, because if we measure a subset of them in the lab, or I have collaborators in Denmark that agreed to do this for me, which is really great. And I just got results this week, actually, which was very exciting. And they used this elemental analyzer. So they looked at nitrogen content, which is a proxy for protein content. And then, of course, I could grow those genotypes that are most different and taste them and see whether I could answer that question for you. So right now, I don't know. But of course, it would be interesting if you could taste. It would also be very useful for me in the field.
You don't have to rely on lab tests, yeah.
But also, you can do a very quick and dirty approach, right? Where you just take a bite and see if it's worth keeping or not.
I suspect it's the kind of thing that you can leverage the lab results where you know this is high protein, this is low protein, and then you taste them and see if you can start training your senses to pick up on what the differences are.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a good idea. I might try that.
Could you see this crop being compatible with other crops, like as an understory for maize, for example?
Well, I think one obvious one would be with the small grain cereals like wheat and barley, because it already grows naturally with them. So I think that could work. I think the main problem would be that it would tend to grow up into their canopy, which I don't think will seriously impact the grains. But if you use modern mechanical harvesting, they would, the stems would probably tangle in the harvesters, the combine harvesters and stuff, these vetches and things like stuff. They don't deal very well with these kind of things.
Might be a trait that you can select for varieties that don't twine, or that they take. I could almost imagine that you get a wheat crop out the first year. You sow the two together, you harvest a wheat crop off the top, and then the Lathyrus grows through the stubble and you get a tuber crop the second year.
Absolutely. And there are, I've been thinking what I've been dreaming of, because that's not the only species I work with. I also work with Conopodium magus, which is a thing called pignut, another grassland tuber crop. And I also play around a little bit with, I like tubers. I think there's something magical about not knowing what you're going to get until you dig it up. It's like unwrapping a gift. And the other one is silverweed. And basically I wondered, could I make, you know the way people do these food forests, right? And they have these hyper-diverse agroecosystems, but whether you could do the same thing and have a food grassland, or you have a kind of perennial grassland, or almost perennial, where you get different kinds of things out of it. And one of them would be above ground perennial grain. So like kernza, this perennial intermediate wheatgrass crop, maybe you've heard of it. So if you were to intercrop that with Aardacker, and you know, after a few years, you need to replace your perennial intermediate wheatgrass because it kind of gets old. And when you do that, you harvest your tubers. Because the tubers are not like potatoes. They grow every year. They don't grow 1 year and then die. Every year they get bigger. And they're extremely frost hardy. They'll grow in northern Siberia. They'll take minus 30 and they're just fine. So you could really have a kind of perennial grassland ecosystem, which is producing food every year for you. And that would be quite cool, I think.
Does that mean that this crop supports, once it's established, a really, really long harvest time? So rather than getting machines in there to harvest it all on the same day, if it was in a backyard situation every day, you could go out and fill a basket with tubers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So you get around the storage problems that you have with some tubers at scale.
Absolutely. So with storage, this thing will store. The only thing is it doesn't like, you cannot let it dry out. So I've managed to store tubers in the fridge in a Ziploc bag for like 8 months and they're fine. But they need to be cold and moist. So if you can satisfy those, you're fine. The best way to do it is in the field. So I should explain the scale that I'm trying to do this on. So I'm doing this all as cheap as possible because it's self-funded at the moment. But I hope I've sold some in advance to a restaurant for this autumn, this harvest. So hopefully that will help cover some of the costs. But I partnered with some local farmers here because, I don't have any land. And they've been very supportive. And that's for growing the tubers. But at the same time, I need to produce the seed, right? If I want to do plant breeding at scale. So this year, I will grow about 50,000 plants in three locations, one on clay in the Netherlands, one on sand in the Netherlands, and one in Greece. So I have a friend of mine who's an almond farmer in Greece who said he'd like to try it out. So then we'll see how it does in these different climatic and soil conditions. This is the first time ever now that I'm doing it at this scale. Before, it's always been very small. And one of the reasons is, you asked me earlier about germplasm, you can get small packs of like 100 yep. seeds from yep. these different places, and then you got to bulk it up yourself. And that's
it takes years without disaster, because it's very tempting to plant most of your seeds 1 year and have a bad season.
Exactly. So I've been doing it in different ways, and I've been bulking it up, and I decided to split my population in two for a number of reasons. So I've basically got an A gene pool and a B gene pool. And now what I've done is I've rented like 500 square meters for the A gene pool, another 500 square meters for the B gene pool, both on clay, and then another 200 square meters for the A and 200 square meters for the B, both on sand. And that's for seed production. So then I plant the tubers. And the reason I'm getting to this is about the storage. I can't afford to put them all in cold storage so that I can plant the tubers in spring. So what I did was, when I harvested the tubers, I went to the farmers, rented the land, and immediately planted them again. And now they spend the whole winter in the ground, which is my storage.
Yep.
And that means, of course, that they're ready to get going in the spring whenever the weather's good. And then I have to come up with a way of getting the seeds. And these are all the things that you have this idea to do breeding. And it's, in essence, really simple what I'm doing, which is a mass selection approach. I can't do anything more complex because I just don't have the capacity for that. I'd need lots of people to help me. But then there are all these things like, well, then if I want to sow 50,000 plants, I need 50,000 seeds. How do I get 50,000 seeds? Well, now I need to start doing seed production. And I did not see how that was going to scale this year. And I spent the last 3 months in my kitchen every evening, basically cleaning seeds, popping them off plants. And I will never do that again in my life. Next time I'm going to have to come up with a more scalable solution. So now I'm going to harvest it like hay, let it dry on the field, swathe it, toss it around. And then there's a farmer nearby with a thresher who said he'd let me use it. And these are the kind of things that you run into when you want to go at scale.
Yeah. Oh, have you considered the potential of any interspecies hybrids within the Lathyrus genus?
I knew you would ask me that. You really like your interspecies hybrids, don't you? I have. The one that immediately jumps out is Lathyrus linifolius. So that's another tuberous Lathyrus species, the bitter vetch. And I've eaten it. It doesn't taste as nice as the Aardacker. It's very, very different, actually. It's more like a licorice-y flavor. The Aardacker tastes kind of like sweet chestnuts, somewhere between sweet chestnuts and potatoes. The only reason I haven't done it yet is it grows in Ireland. It doesn't grow in the Netherlands. And I haven't managed to get my hands on germplasm because it's not something that is easy to buy seeds of for some reason. And if I do get it, I'm going to have to, they flower at different times. So the bitter vetch flowers in, you know, April, and the Aardacker flowers in June. So I'm going to have to probably keep some of the bitter vetch in the fridge until April and then plant it out and make sure that they overlap and then see. And the reason that I would do that is because the bitter vetch has an interesting plant architecture. It doesn't really climb as much. It's more bushy. And that would be nice in a way, because the climbing of the Aardacker is nice when it has a support. And it does all right without a support, because it is naturally a grassland species, so it can handle that. But it does get kind of tangled and messy, and
you have to do that. Keep in mind, you could potentially store the pollen I'm pretty sure the pea family is reasonable for storing pollen.
I should try that. I collected pollen today, actually, because I have some in a green. I have like a little greenhouse that I had some plants in.
Yeah, most families, if you just dry it over a drying agent and then freeze it, you'll get at least a few months of storage.
Yeah, I should try that. I should try that. But first, I have to get myself some bitter vetch.
Yeah. Yep.
and then I'll see if it works. I don't know for sure if it will work because they seem to be so-called true species, good species, in the sense that the Lathyrus species, they grow like there's other Lathyrus species that grow here, like Lathyrus latifolius, Lathyrus sylvestris, Lathyrus pratensis, and they never hybridize with each other. Never. And they can grow right beside each other. So I think there might be some species barriers.
They're negotiable as well. There's tricks that you could use to wiggle around them. Just depends on how determined you are.
Yeah, so I will give it a shot just because it'll be kind of fun to try. You know?
Here's an interesting thing, though. Just there's a report I saw recently from somewhere in Eastern Europe way back. They took sunflower and did controlled hybridization with every other Asteraceae that they could get their hands on. And pretty much all of them produced viable hybrids. It's another
really?
One. Yeah. And I don't know, like, not every family is as amenable to that. Some, it seems to vary, but spontaneous hybridization not happening isn't always a good indicator that there are genetic barriers. It could just be that different bees, like even the same species of bees, often specialize in different kinds of flowers, that like from the same hive, one bee will go out and pollinate all the sunflowers and another one will go out and have a taste for the Ardeca.
Well, I've spent a lot of time watching the bees on Ardeca, and I've even got a whole iNaturalist page studying the Ardeca pollinators. And it's been really fascinating. So it is one of those cool things about choosing a species that not a lot is known about, is that you can figure it out yourself, which is very satisfying. So I've just sat in front of these flowers for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. Days, like every time I'd take a cup of tea during the day for a lunch break, I would just go outside and just watch the flowers. And the Ardeca flowers, it's like a classic pea flower. So at the back, you have this standard petal, which is this, it's called a standard petal. Then you have two wing petals, which are sticking out towards the front, and they're either side of a thing called a keel petal. And it's called a keel petal because it looks like a keel of a boat. And inside the keel petal is the stigma and the stamens. That's where all the reproductive material is. Now, for the bees to get the nectar, they need to sort of get in between those two wing petals and push down the keel petal. Then they get the nectar, and up comes the stigma, which then comes over, because the thing is asymmetrical, it always comes over their right shoulder and hits them on the back and dumps the pollen there. And then they collect a bit of the pollen. And it's only really pollinated by leafcutter bees, like a Chile. Honeybees don't like it. They don't go for it.
It's hard.
And
work.
If they do go for it, they bypass the pollination mechanism and steal the nectar. And what is really fascinating is the leafcutter bees know what's going to happen. And when they land, they keep their left wing open and they close their right wing because they know that up over their shoulder, this thing is going to come and hit them. And I don't think this is published anywhere or anything, but this is one of those things, if you just sit and watch, you start to see these things. Mm. And it's really, really fun. And then what's fun is that because opening it up requires the strength of a bee, the hoverflies follow the bees and the butterflies follow the bees. They can't open it up. But once it's open, it stays open for like 10 minutes before it slowly closes back. And I have videos of the hoverflies following the bees and then eating the pollen off the stigma, and butterflies doing the same thing, but in their case, sucking the nectar. So you see this whole interaction of all these species.
And you get to breathe in that beautiful perfume while you're observing all of this.
Yes, it is. It's very nice. It's very nice.
I'm jealous. I first learned controlled pollination on stapeliads, because I used to collect them when I was a teenager. And they all smell like some different dead thing. So,
well, I cut my teeth on Arabidopsis thaliana, and those flowers are about a millimeter across. So that made me find everything else pretty easy.
I've got some kinopod pollination to do this winter that I'm gearing up for. So also very tiny, but very exposed. Like I don't have to like get all these petals out of the way beforehand. So hopefully that goes fairly smoothly. Okay, so we're reaching the bonus round questions. I think we've covered everything pretty well. we were going to talk more widely about other tuberous legumes because there's quite a family of them, and most of them seem to be low yield, high quality crops that have never really taken off. But yeah, probably another time I'll have to find someone. Come back one day and we'll just talk about tuberous legumes in general.
I'd be happy to.
Would be wonderful. Okay, so I just ran questions. If you could like work wonders and wave a magic wand with any species, what would you bring into the world?
Yeah, so I had this. What was funny was I listened to your podcast and you spoke about extra floral nectaries. And I had the same idea a couple of years ago. And I imagined creating trees that would like, you could just milk for nectar and you would just, you know, hook them all up. And then you could basically not damage the forest or the ecosystem. And it would just give you raw material for precision fermentation or whatever it is that you would like to do. So that was one thing that I thought I'd mention just because I found it striking how similar the idea was. If I could really wave a magic wand, of course, then I would go for trees, because that's the thing that we just don't live long enough to breed properly. And then, you know, if I had that thousands of years to do something like that, I think deep down inside, I'd like to breed really like to make massive trees, you know, bigger than the redwoods. Because I just think that would just be so awesome. You know, like the forest of Lothlorien from Lord of the Rings, and then we could live in them and they would be just living houses. And that would just be a wonderful vision for me. I just think it would be really beautiful.
Have you seen photos of the baobab houses in Madagascar?
Yeah, they're amazing. Those trees look like somebody with a great imagination had some time to do breeding, all right.
Mm. But yeah, I mean, that's similar to the acacia ants that have those swollen, what are they called? On the base of the thorns that are swollen.
Oh, yeah, they, yeah, yeah. I've seen them when I was in Kenya. Yeah. I stood on one of them, went through my boot. Oh, those things are vicious.
Painful.
They're vicious.
But we need something like that, but on a human scale. We need a tiny house for one person in the size of a tree.
Yeah, you could just, I don't know, put some stimulant and then the tree would grow in a shape around you and then you have your home, just like the ants do for the acacias.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, next question. What is your vision for the future of food in your community?
So my vision is one, I suppose I can sum it up with diversity. And I mean diversity at all levels. So I suppose in some ways I'm a bit of a heretic in all the communities, because people who are interested in super low input aren't interested in the high input vertical farming kind of stuff. And my view is that we should be exploring all of these options. And our food system of the future should include all of them, both super high tech and super low tech. And the diversity is what will bring us the resilience and allow us to both allow space for complete wildness and nature, but also then live in diverse agroecosystems and everything in between. Because some people will want to live in cities, others won't. So diversity, I think, is where we will get our resilience. And that's what I try to do with my work, is I work both in a diversity of production systems, but with a diversity of crops with very, very different goals. And in a way, I hedge my bets. I mean, the Aardakker is going to be a useful technology. Should civilization collapse, that will still be a useful thing, whereby the peas and the wheat in the indoor farming, those are for a more techno-optimistic future.
Yeah, hedge your bets. That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
And how do you hope to pass on your work to future generations?
So to some extent, I feel like the way I will pass it on is the way that all plant breeders have passed on their work for the past 10,000 years, which is the work I do will be written in the genome of the plants I've worked with. And I hope that, you know, over time, other people will grow them. And, you know, all of those generations that went before me, I use the material that they've worked with any of the domestic species for sure. And that's kind of how I view the really lasting impact as a plant breeder, is that it's there, it's in the seed, it's in the species. Other than that, in a more active way, I do try to do some outreach. I do some science communication. And yeah, I'm happy to share knowledge and experiences in that regard.
It sounds like you're well advanced in reaching out to other growers for scaling up as well, too. I'm really impressed with that.
Yeah, that's actually, it's probably easier to do the breeding than it is to do the networking, to be honest. But if you don't do it, you won't be able to get anywhere. So yeah.
Now, what's your final message to people who are thinking of getting into plant breeding themselves?
it's just do it. I mean, it's so much fun. And I think it's also important to realize that there's so many ways to do it. And you don't have to go down any particular route. You can take a very hands-off approach, like the land-race gardening. Although I would encourage people to do some controlled crosses, just because once you do that between two, let's pick tomatoes and you pick a yellow and a red with two different shaped fruits. And then when you grow your F1, you start to see some of the genetics of which is dominant and which is recessive. And then in the offspring, the grandchildren, you get everything. You get such a diversity. And that's so much fun. Once you realize the potential of what's there and what you can unlock by just allowing things to mix up. And then, it's just
I would
fun.
Point
so
out
I
too
would
that
say just go and do it.
Controlled crossing can be a bit of a pain, but you don't have to do it forever. Like, you often only have to do it once with a project. And then you're just dealing with the explosion of diversity after that.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's also fun to understand, I suppose, the reproductive organs of a flower and how to do it. And it does give you a sense of, there's an intentionality associated with it, which I think you can derive a lot of satisfaction from. But at the end of the day, it's just amazing to see what can pop out of these two. Even if you choose two similar looking plants, sometimes in their offspring, you can get all sorts of things popping out. And that's just a lot of fun. So I would say, go and do it. And for me anyway, maybe I just add one thing. I have sort of personal principles with regards to plant breeding in terms of choosing crops. One is that it should generate some sort of value, ideally something filling a niche, which I think is not present. That's one principle that I look for. And that's like the art hacker, right? There is no commercially available protein-rich tuber crop, or at least not at scale. Two would be that it's different, right? So one of the other species I work with is Ficaria verna, and this is Lesser Celandine. So it's in the Ranunculaceae, which is a family where there's not a lot of other crops in. Mm-hmm. So thinking in terms of sustainability of crop rotations, if you go to another family, there's less diseases that are shared. So that's another criteria. And then finally, it should be just fun. It should be something that catches your personal interest. And it doesn't have to satisfy all three of those, right? As long as it satisfies one of them, that's enough. And then I would go for it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. As a final opportunity to plug anything that you want, how can people get in touch with you or learn more about the work that you do?
So I have a website for the company where I do mostly the Nova domestication work, the Aardacker, and that's called Aardaia. So that's Aardaia. It's a mixture of Aard, Earth, and Gaia, Mother Earth, because the crops are of the earth and for the earth. And so you can find me there. So aardaia.com. And then you can just like, you can, if you have a message, you can send it through there. The website, I'm still working on it. So don't expect anything beautiful. I'm better in the field than I am behind the computer. So
no, that's all good. I'll put all those links in the description for the episode. And thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Brilliant.